We never burned our cities. Who said it was a southern problem? It's a world problem. You finally come up with something. As we talked, he said nigger less, as if he'd drained the poison for a while. He didn't soften. He just expressed himself in other terms, although at no time did he try to hide where he stood. But he held more sorrow and regret than hatred. He was more empty than malicious. 4. Martin Luther King Jr. Drive used to be Sylvan Street. Some whites in Selma still called it Sylvan Street. It's the main route through the so-called Project, a typical federally sponsored housing district, and the street the Southern Christian Leadership Conference assembled the marchers on, using the block under the high steeple of Brown's Chapel as the starting point. The first marchers walked down Sylvan, as it was then, up Water Avenue, turned left, and started across Pettus Bridge, about half a mile. At the other end of the bridge, deputies and troopers, shouting to the people they had no permit to march, forced them back to Water Street. But for once, chants and signs and feet were better weapons than anything the state could summon. Whitman, the egalitarian, said it a century before. "I will make a song for the ears of the president, full of weapons with menacing points, and behind the weapons, countless dissatisfied faces." When King assembled the marchers again 2 weeks later, he had not only a permit, he had also the protection, albeit spotty, of federal troops called out by President Johnson, the man with the big ears. People gathered at Brown's Chapel and walked 50 miles to Montgomery. The two marches roused Washington as none of the other SCLC confrontations had, and a few months later the Congress passed the Federal Voting Rights Act. It was dark and moonless when I started looking for Brown's Chapel. I planned just to drive by, but I stopped near a big brick church that fit the description to ask a black man if it was the chapel. "That's it," he said. "What difference does it make?" Without knowing it, he had asked me the question I come to Selma to answer. "Isn't this where King started the march? What they say? So who cares?" I stood on the step of the van. "I'm trying to find out if things have changed since the march. Tell you in three words, ain't nothing changed." "Let me ask another question. Could you get a drink in Mickey's tonight?" "Go ask me if I want in there, because I'll tell you, they don't got to keep this man out because he don't want in." "I hear you, but could you? Minute I do, it's membership time." "I just went in and nobody said anything about membership. Your membership's got a way of standing out. Just like mine." Several teenagers gathered around. I was the wrong color, on the wrong street, but no one said anything. The man talking to me was James Walker, born and raised in the Selma Project and just discharged from 4 years in the Air Force. "Been almost 10 years to the day since King got shot," he said, "and the movement's been dead that long. Things slipping. Black man's losing ground again. My mama's afraid to talk to a white, and my grandmama don't care. She just worries about the kids." "Didn't the march do anything you can see?" "Say what?" "Last week I went to get my driver's license. 12:30. Lunchtime. Sign on the door. Says they open again at 1. I wanted to wait inside, so I pulled on the door. Tripper comes out and says, 'What's wrong, fool? Can't read? Get off that door, unless you want me next time coming out shooting.'" "How's your change?" "Where?" 10 years ago, he would have come out shooting the first time." "What happened?"
"Nothing, dude. This man's not stupid. I know when to shut up and I know when to talk. This man knows when he's got a chance."
A police car cruised by. A teenager said,
"That's twice."
A Buick pulled up and Walker got in. He said,
"You're making people nervous coming in down here. You ain't the right color, you know. Better watch your ass tonight."
The car jumped forward, then backed up.
"If you ain't jiving about the church, come round the basketball court in the morning."
I drove out to George Corley Wallace Community College, one of three new schools by that name in the state. Sometime after midnight, the ghost shook a little, and I woke up. It shook again. I crept to the front curtain. A man standing on the bumper played a light over the seats.
Just as I opened the door, he got into a squad car. "What's wrong?" I called out. "Only checking, neighbor." He drove off quickly. I closed up again and went back to bed. Checking? What the hell for? 5. At 10 the next morning, I was back on King Drive, a block south of where it crosses Jefferson Davis Avenue. On the basketball court, Walker was alone, juking and shooting.
"Hey, you showed up!"
For the first time, I saw him smile. "Just working on my game till school starts. Didn't get out of the Air Force in time to make spring term."
"What school?"
"Alabama Lutheran, here in Selma. All black, which is what I want. I'm tired of hassling with whites. Got enough in the force."
"You don't want to go north or west?
And be a minority? That ain't my land."
"What'll you do here?"
"Study guidance counseling. I'm staying where I can do some good. 55% of Selma's black. We got potential. First, though, brother's got to see what's on the other side of Pettus Bridge, see where to go from here."
"What do you mean?"
"I mean figuring a new course. King said turn the other cheek. Malcolm X said fight fire with fire. I don't want that. But we got to show the brothers they can do more than just hang cool like meat in a locker."
"Maybe things haven't changed because of apathy in the project."
"I ain't letting nobody off that easy. A man shouldn't have got to care so much about getting a fair game. You got to worry every day about a fair game?"
"Not usually."
"So why should this man? Sure, the brothers could do more, and they would if they didn't spend so much time getting and keeping a job."
"Wears a man out. It never quits. If a brother gets hot and then gets active, there goes the job he worked his ass off to get."
"Can't legally let a man go if he's not talking around on company time."
"They don't fire him. Ain't that clean? They hassle him. Get him thinking new ideas ain't worth it. Stay on him till he quits. A mover gets to stay only if boss man's under quota. Otherwise, carry your hat in your hand."
A friend of Walker's came up.
"Saw you down here last night," he said. "We don't get many calls from your people."
His name was Charles Davis. He worked the middle shift at a battery factory.
"I'll tell you about jobs. If I quit mine and go over to the job office, they'll hand me a shovel or send me to Florida to pick oranges. I can do more than dig a hole or cut a weed."
"A lot of people in the project feel like they can't be nobody," Walker said. "Me? I feel I can be President of the United States."
"Shit, man," Davis said. "Force must have did your brain housing group in."
"I know things ain't changed, but things gonna change."
"Young and mad, and believe so much," Davis said.
"I'm 24 and he's 31, so I am from nowhere. I'm talking future. Anyway, this man wants to know about the march."
"Think I was 15, Davis said. "Made both marches. People be saying we wasted our time, but things are better. At least a little bit."
"Ain't nothing changed, didn't have to change," Walker said.
"Some of those things be important, though. But a lot of times, it's like always. Take yesterday. I put a quarter in a soda pop machine at the gas station. Money keeps coming down. Two honkies sit watching. I ask if the machine was broke. And one honker says it takes 30 cents now. Machine says 25 on it. Then he says, 'Wondered how long before you figured it out.' He couldn't tell me they changed it. I said, 'Don't take long to figure you,' and walked off. Other honker says, 'Want me to whoop the nigger?' 5 years ago, I'd have fought him. Now I try to ignore it. But hey, I used to follow Malcolm X."
"I'll tell you one," Walker said. "Alabama state motto is defending our rights. And that's all we're doing, all the time."
"Motto don't have you in mind, James."
"Better start."
"Hey, we finally got a black Santa Claus at the mall. Only thing, he scared hell out of the little black kids. They be dreaming of a white Christmas."
"That's just education," I said. "Yeah, but you see how far it goes. Littlest things, work and worry. Gotta always have your back in the air, and that wears you down, just like they want. Here's another one. 6 people killed in the project last year, and nobody's gone uptown for murder yet. If a white dude gets it, somebody goes uptown inside 3 weeks. Maybe the wrong man, but somebody's gone. Law don't care what we do to ourselves. Black on black's outside their law. No black police?
They be worse than a honky pig.
Those black mother heads will manhandle you. Nothing but Oreos. Black out, white in.
All honky law wants is get a man in jail so's they know where he's at.
But whites that run things here don't mind a little black boondang now and then. That's their contribution to equality. Hump a nigger.
Yeah. But let a black dude even walk down the street next to a white woman, and in 6 months they go and frame you. Go and plant some dope in your ride or your house. Put a white bitch on you and pay her to yell rape. They come up with something. They want our best women, but they take you uptown if you say hey to a honky woman. None of them would touch with a fence rail.
We walked around to a small, windowless brick sweet shop run by a blind man named Louis. Davis bought 3 cigarettes, lit one, and put 2 under his hat. A white candy vendor came in. Louis asked how many of each item he was leaving. They conducted the transaction on trust. Davis said,
"So why'd it rip you, Louis?"
"No, you didn't. Candyman ain't ripping off old Louis."
Walker and I drank grape knee-high. He said,
"Louis, tell the man here what it was like when we all did the march." "Louis done a business like he never seen." "Just business to you, ain't that right, Louis? Business be business."
Outside the shop, Davis said,
"I'll tell you a funny one. Last week watching at the ball game, a couple of us sitting on the fender of some Pontiac. Little bitty white dude comes up dragging a baseball bat. He's just learning to talk. He says, 'You niggers get off my daddy's car.' Couldn't hardly pronounce nigger." We laughed. Then daddy comes up and moves the car and never says nothing. We never blamed the kid. We know where it's coming from.
A uniformed man drove by in a Bell telephone truck. Walker nudged Davis.
"That's 4 today. 2 last night."
"What's going on?" I said.
"Sheriff's deputy. That's their undercover truck."
"Great undercover to wear a uniform," I said. "Why are they watching you?"
"They ain't watching us, my man. They be watching you."
"Me? Why me? They think I'm agitating?" Walker and Davis laughed derisively.
"They don't give a shit about that. They think you're the dope man."
"A dealer? How did they come up with that?"
"Eyeballs, man. White dude in the project at night driving a van, northern license.
Yeah, man, you be dealing all right."
"If you ain't, they gonna put some stuff on you if you look like trouble."
"A cop checked the truck over last night.
Picking information, figuring how to handle you. When they pull you in, you gonna be surprised they know the size of your jockstrap."
"You got any stuff, hide it good or dump it. Don't try to sell now."
"I've got beer and some bourbon. Clean as a whistle."
"Until they stop you and look you right over."
"Stay long enough, and they gonna get you. 2 miles over the speed limit, forgetting to signal, something."
"To them, you'd be worse than a nigger now."
Davis had to go to work, and Walker had someone to see. I headed up Broad Street. Clean, orderly Broad Street. I'd gone into the project for a few hours, and already I felt marked. I was suspicious. Just paranoia, of course. On the way out of town, I passed 3 police cars stationed at intersections. They must have been only waiting for traffic to clear because no one followed me. But I drove under the speed limit, came to absolute stops at every light and sign, signaled turns a block ahead, and I hardly took my eyes off the rearview mirror. What a way to go. 6. Uniontown, Demopolis, the Tombigbee River, and Blue Highway 28. I missed the turnoff to Suquamish, Mississippi, and had to enter the state by way of Scuba on Route 16, a road of trees and farmhouses. The farmhouses weren't the kind with large encircling porches and steeply pitched roofs and long windows you used to see, but rather new houses indistinguishable from wet bar, walkout basement, turf builder plus suburban models. Then Philadelphia, Mississippi. Here, too, the old sad history. The town, like others in the area, was built over the site of a Choctaw village. The Choctaw, whose land once covered most of Mississippi, earned a name from their skill in horticulture and diplomacy. They were a sensible people, whose chieftains attained position through merit. In the early 19th century, they learned from white men and began building schools and adding livestock to their farms. Later, whites would refer to them as one of the five civilized tribes. Nevertheless, as pressure from white settlement increased, the Choctaw had to cede to the government one piece of land, in million-acre increments, after another. Federal agents pressured tribes to sign treaties through mixed bloods, bribed with whiskey and trinkets. They promised Indians annuities, land grants, and reparations, almost none of which the Congress ever paid. To President Andrew Jackson, it made no difference that Choctaw officers like Oklahoma had fought with him against rebellious Creeks. Jackson pushed on with land-gobbling compacts. With the Treaty of Dancing Rabbit Creek, held in the woods northeast of Philadelphia, the Choctaw gave up the last of their land and reluctantly agreed to leave Mississippi forever. They walked to the arid Indian Territory, where they set up their own republic, modeled after the government that had just dispossessed them. It's a sad history, not because of the influx of settlers. After all, Indians had encroached upon each other for thousands of years. It's a sad history because of the shabby way the new people dealt with tribal Americans, not just the lies, but the utter unwillingness to share an enormous land. Yet 1,000 or so Choctaw secretly stayed in Mississippi to claim land promised, although few ever saw a single acre returned. That afternoon, their descendants were shopping along the square in Philadelphia, eating a hot dog at the Powwow Drive-In, taking a few hours away from the reservation west of town. Holding to the token parcel now theirs, they could watch towns white men had built wither, improve, enterprise, increase, energy, progress. As for what the land around the towns produced, they could watch that too. Highway 16 passed through green fields, blue ponds, clumps of pine. It crossed the earthy Yauconhoahna River, a name that stands with other rivers of strong name in Mississippi, the Yazoo, Yallabusha, Little Flower, Noxubee, Homochito, Bogachito, Chickasawa, Skuna, the Singing River. At Oklahoma, I drove onto the Natchez Trace Parkway, a two-lane running from Natchez to near Nashville, which follows a 500-mile trail first opened by buffalo and Indians. Chickasaws called it the Path of Peace. In 1810, the trace was the main return route for Ohio Valley traders who, rather than fight the Mississippi currents, sold their flatboats for scrap in Natchez and walked home on the trace. The poor sometimes traveled by a method called ride and tie. Two men would buy a mule. One would ride until noon, then tie the animal to a tree and walk until his partner behind caught up on the jack that evening. By mid-century, steamboats made the arduous and dangerous trek unnecessary, and the trace disappeared in the trees. Now, new road, opening the woods again, went in among red buds and white blossoms of dogwood, curving about under a cool evergreen cover. For miles, no power lines or billboards, just tree, rock, water, bush, and road. The new trace, like a river, followed natural contours and gave focus to the land. It so brought out the beauty that every road commissioner in the nation should drive the trace to see that highway does not have to outrage landscape. Northeast of Taugaloo, I stopped to hike a trail into a blackwater swamp of tupelo and bald cypress. The sun couldn't cut through the canopy of buds and branches, and the slow water moved darkly. In the muck, pollywogs were starting to squirm. It was spring here, and juices were getting up in the stalks. Leaves, terribly folded in husks, had begun to let loose and open to the light. Stuff was stirring in the rot. Water bubbled with the froth of sperm and ova, and the whole bog lay rank and eggy, vaporous and thick, with the scent of procreation. Things once squeezed close, pinched shut, things waiting to become something else, something greater, were about ready. I had a powerful sense of life going about the business of getting on with itself. Pointed phallic sprouts pressed up out of the ooze. Green vegetable heads came up from the mire to sniff for vegetation of kin. Staminate and pistillate, they rose to the thrall of the oldest rhythms. Things were growing so fast I could almost feel the heat from their generation, the slow friction of leaf against bud case, petal against petal. For some time I stood among the high mysteries of being, as they consumed the decay of old life. Then I went back to the trace, and followed dusk around the spread of Jackson highways that had broken open like aneurysms, and leaked out strawberry syrup pancakes, magic finger motel beds, and double cheese pizzas. Across the Pearl River, and into Clinton, a hamlet that Sherman pillaged but decided not to burn. The place was shut down. Near the campus of Old Mississippi College, I parked for the night and ate a tin of tuna and three soft carrots. Rejected the chopped liver. I ate only because I didn't know what else to do. I'd got uppity about multi-lane America and was paying the price. Secretly, I hungered for a texturized patty of genetically engineered cow. 7. A century and a half ago, the founders of Mississippi College hoped the school would become the state university. But that didn't work out, so they gave it to the Presbyterians. That didn't work out either, and the Presbyterians gave it back. The Baptists had a go at it, and the college got on in its own quiet way, eventually turning out three governors. Actually, all the changing around may have made little difference. A student told me that everyone in town was a Baptist anyway, even the Presbyterians. I was eating breakfast in the cafeteria. A crew-cut student wearing mesh step-in casuals sat down to a tall stack of pancakes. He was a methodical fellow. After a prayer running almost a minute, he pulled from his briefcase a Bible, reading stand, clips to hold the book open, a green felt tip, a pink, and yellow. Next came a squeeze bottle of liquid margarine, a bottle of log cabin syrup wrapped in plastic, a linen napkin, and one of those little lemony wet wipes. The whole business looked like the old circus act where 12 men get out of a car the size of a trash can. A woman with a butter almond smile sat down across from me. Her hair, fresh from the curling wand, dropped in loose coils the color of polished pecan, and her breasts, casting shadows to her waist, pressed full against a glossy dress that looked wet. A golden cross swung gently between, and high on her long throat was a small Pisces amulet. Her dark, musky scent brought to mind the swamp. We nodded, and she said in soft Mississippian, "You were very interested in Jerry's pancakes." It was the briefcase. I thought he was going to pull out a water pick and the Ark of the Covenant next. "He's a nice boy. His parameters just aren't yours." She couldn't have surprised me more had she said fluxinus and nihila pillification. "The bottom line is always parameters, no matter what the input." "Let me make a crazy guess. You're in computer programming."
"I'm in business, but my brother is a computer programmer in Jackson. He's got me interested in it. He plays with the computer after hours. Made up his Christmas cards on an IBM 36158 last year, and did his own wedding invitations 2 years ago. But we're channelized different. I want to use the computer to enrich spiritual life. Maybe put prayers on a computer like that company in California that programs them. For $2, they run your prayer through twice a day for a week. They send up $10,000 a month."
"What if God doesn't know Fortran?"
"Come on, you. People are critical, but they don't ridicule prayer wheels or rosaries, and those are just prayer machines."
"Does God get a printout?"
"Quit it. You get the printout, suitable for framing. Quit smiling."
"Sorry, but you said they send the prayers up, and I just wondered what kind of hard copy we're dealing with here."
"You're a fuddy-dud. It's all just modalities. The prayer still has to come from a heart. Japanese write prayers on slips of paper and tie them to branches so the wind sort of distributes them. Same thing. People just trying to maximize the prayer function."
"You're a Pisces?"
Would a Sagittarius wear a Pisces necklace?
How can you believe in astrology and wear a cross?
What a fuddy-dud. Who made the stars? Astrology is just another modality, too.
She took a computer card from her notebook.
I've got to get to class, but here's one more modality. In India, people pray when they eat, like each chew is a prayer. Try it sometime. Even grumpy fuddy-duds like it.
She handed me the card and hurried off. Here it is, word for word. Scripture cake. 2 cups Proverbs, 30:33. 3.5 cups Exodus, 29:2. 3 cups Jeremiah, 6:20. 2 cups 1 Samuel, 30:12. 2 cups Nahum, 3:12. 1/2 cup Judges, 4:19. 1 cup Genesis, 43:11. 6, Isaiah, 10:14. 2 tablespoons 1 Corinthians, 5:6. 1 tablespoon 1 Samuel, 14:25. Season with 1 Kings, 10:10. Follow Leviticus, 24:5. Serve with love. Sally. 8. I went to the trace again, following it through pastures and pecan groves and tilled fields, wildflowers and clover pressed in close, and from trees long purple droops of wisteria hung like grape clusters. In one pond a colony of muskrats. I turned off near Learned and drove northwest across the Mississippi at Vicksburg. South of town I ate a sandwich where Civil War earthworks stuck out on a bluff high above the river. From these areas, cannoneers had lobbed shells onto Union gunboats running the river. Anything, a rock, a stick, falling from that height must have hit with a terrible impact. The western side of the river was Louisiana, and the hills of Mississippi gave way to low and level cotton fields where humid heat waves boiled up, turning dusty tractors into shimmering distortions. The temperature climbed to 86. Once a big oak or gum grew in the middle of each of these fields, and under them the farmer ate dinner, cooled the team, took an afternoon nap. Now, because they interfered with air-conditioned powerhouse tractors plowing the acres, few of the tall trees remained. The traffic on U.S. 80 had gone to I-20, and the two-lane carried only farm trucks and tractors pulling big canisters of liquid fertility. The federal highway, like most I'd driven, was much rougher than state or county highways, so we all went slowly, just trundling along in the heat. A traveler who leaves the journey open to the road finds unforeseen things come to shape it. The fecundity of the unexpected, Proudhon called it. The Cajun fried chicken stand in Monroe, accent the first syllable, where I'd stopped for gas, determined the direction of the next several days. I wasn't interested in franchise chicken, but the word Cajun brought up the scent of gumbo, hot boudin, and dirty rice. Monroe is a long way from Cajun land, but while the tank filled, I decided to head south for some genuine Cajun cooking. On the other side of the pump, a man with arms the size of my thighs waited for the nozzle. He said, "You driving through, or what?" "On my way south." "You want some meat?" It sounded aggressive, like, "Want a knuckle sandwich?" "Pardon me?" "You want meat? I'm flying out of Shreveport this afternoon. Can't carry the steaks with me. Just got called to Memphis. If you're cooking out, might as well take them. It's you or the garbage can." He had a way with words. "Get in the steaks, Roger." A boy, about 10, came around and handed me 4 nice flank cuts, still frozen. I thanked the man.
"What did you pay for your Ford?"
the boy said. $3,000 in round numbers.
"How much to build the insides?"
"Couple $100.
"How about that homemade bed? Could I try it?"
I opened the door. He jumped on the bunk, stretched out, and made a loud snoring noise. Dreaming of fireplaces. His eyes popped open.
"Inflation's added about 12%. These models run higher now, too. How's the gas mileage?"
"Around 25 to the gallon."
"Can't be."
"Can be and is. Straight shift, no factory options except high back seats,
lightweight, and I drive around 50. That short man of a boy depressed me. 10 years old and figuring the rate of interest and depreciation instead of the cost of adventure. His father handed me a loaf of bread. "Thanks very kindly," I said, "but I'm not much for white bread. Just have to leave it along the interstate for possums and niggers." He did it again. With the steaks and white bread, would go well with chopped liver, I drove south toward the flat, wet triangle of Gulf Central Louisiana that is Cajun land. The highway clattered ghost dancing and shook me so that my head bounced like one of those plastic dogs in car rear windows. The heat made me groggy, and I couldn't shake it, and I didn't want to stop. After a while, the road seemed a continuum of yellow-lined concrete, a Mobius strip where I moved, going neither in nor out, but around and up and down to all points of the compass, yet always rolling along on the same plane. My eyes were nearly closed. Then a dark face staring in. My head snapped back, and I pulled the truck out of the left lane, a hitchhiker. I stopped. His skin shone like wet Delta mud, and his smile glittered like a handful of new dimes. He was heading home to Coushatta after spending 2 days thumbing along I-20 from Birmingham, where he'd looked for work as a machinist. He'd found nothing. Usually he got long rides on freeways if he could manage one, but it was easier for a black man to get a lift on the small roads where there were more Negro drivers. Sometimes the ride included a meal and bed, but last night he'd slept in a concrete culvert. I asked where he learned his trade.
"In the army, I was a Spec 4.
"Were the jobs filled in Birmingham?"
"They said they were. I don't know."
"Was it a racial question, do you think?" He moved warily in his seat.
"Can't always tell. It's easy to say that."
"What will you do now?
Go home and wait for something to open up?"
We rode quietly, the even land green and still. He was a shy man and appeared uncertain about what to say. I filled some silence, and then he said, "Seems things I wait for don't come along, and the ones I want to see pass on by stop and settle in. I'm between jobs myself, waiting for something to open up, too. I hope I'm just between jobs. I went in the army to learn a trade. Figured I'd found a good one for civvy life. Now I'm looking like my uncle. He only had one good job in his life. Good for his time, anyway. Ran an elevator at the Roosevelt Hotel in New Orleans. Then they put in push-button elevators. He said he drove his old elevator 100,000 miles. He came back to Coushatta and did a little field work, then went hunting a better job in Dallas and got shot dead. I used to think he must have been a bum. Don't see it like that now." The rest of the way was mostly quiet.
"I'll get out here," he said at last.
"A man gave me some steaks. My cooler won't keep them in this heat. Why don't you take a couple?" I pulled out a steak and handed him the rest. "Gave me this bread, too. Take it if you like." He put the steaks in his plaid suitcase, but had to carry the bread in his hand.
"Can I ask you a question?" "Why did you give me a ride?"
"I was dozing off. Owed you for waking me up." He shook his head.
"Maybe. It'll be a good night at home. Mama loves steak."
Up the road he went, thumb out, smiling into the tinted windshields. Home is the hunter, home from the hill. Home the sailor, home from the sea. And what about the specialist for, home from Birmingham? 9. All the way to Opelousas, I thought of the machinist whose name I never learned. He had gone out and come back, only to find a single change. He was older. Sometimes a man's experience is like the sweep secondhand on a clock, touching each point in its circuit, but always the arcs of movement repeating. Near Ville Platte, a scene of three colors. Beside a black Angus in a green pasture, a white cattle egret waited for grubbings the cow stirred up. The improbable pair seemed to know each other well, standing close yet looking opposite directions. I don't know what the egret did before it flew into the New World. I suppose it took its long, reedy legs to shallow water and picked in the bottoms for a couple of million years, each bird repeating until the new way of life came to it. I switched on the radio and turned the dial. Somewhere between a shill for a drive-up savings and loan and one for salvation, I found a raucous music, part bluegrass fiddle, part Texas guitar, part Highland concertina. Cajun voices sang an old, flattened French, part English, part undecipherable. Looking for live Cajun music, I stopped in Opelousas, at the plantation lounge. Somebody sat on every bar stool, but a small man, seeing a stranger, jumped down, shook my hand, and insisted I take his seat. In the fast roll of Cajun English, he said it was the guest stool, and by right belonged to me. The barmaid, a woman with coiled eyes, brought a jacks. "Is there Cajun music here tonight?" I asked. "Jukebox is all music tonight," she snapped. A man called Walt, with dark hair oiled and slicked back in the style of an older time, squeezed in beside me. "If you're looking for French music, you need to get yourself to Lafayette." "What's that mean?" "Means haul your butt to Lafayette. Biggest coon-ass city in the world." "Lafayette?" I made it three syllables. "You got it, Junior, but we don't say Lafayette. Where should I go in Lafayette?" He drew a map so detailed I could almost see chuck holes in the streets. "Called Arix. That's one place. In Lafayette, they got whatever you want. Music, hooch, girls, fights, everything." He passed the bar peanuts. "By the way, Junior," he asked casually, "ever had yourself a Cajun woman?" His question silenced the bar. "Don't think I have." "Got some advice for you, then, if you find you ever need it." It was the quietest bar I'd ever been in. I answered so softly, no sound came out, and I had to repeat, "What advice?" "Take off your belt before you climb on so you can strap your Yankee ass down, because you'll get taken for a ride, up the walls and around." Now the whole bar was staring. I guessed to surmise whether my Yankee ass was worth strapping down. One rusty geezer said, "Junior ain't got no belt." Walt looked at my suspenders and pulled one, letting it snap back. "My man," he said, "tie on with these and you'll get zanged out the window like in a slingshot." The men pounded the bar and choked on their Dixie beer. One began coughing and had to be slapped on the back. Two repeated the joke. Walt shouted to the barmaid, "Let's get Junior another Jacks." To me, he said, "Don't ever take no offense at a coon ass. We're all fools in God's garden, except for betting. Now that's serious. These boys'll bet on anything that moves or scores points, and even some things that don't do neither. Charles here, for example, will bet he can guess to within four how many spots on any Dalmatian dog. I bet on movement because I don't know dogs, and not too many things score points. But everything moves, sooner or later, even heels. Old Chicksaw taught me that." 10. If you've read Longfellow, you can't miss Cajun land once you get to the heart of it. Evangeline Downs, horses. Evangeline Speedway, autos. Evangeline Thruway, trucks. Evangeline Drive-In. And, someone had just said, the Sweet Evangeline Whorehouse. I found my way among the Evangelines into an industrial area of Lafayette, a supply depot for bayou and offshore drilling operations. Along the streets were oil rig outfitters where everything was sections of steel. Pipes, frames, ladders, derricks, piles, cables, buoys, tanks. Crude oil opened Acadian Louisiana as nothing in the past three centuries had. And it seemed as if little could be left unfound in Cajun hamlets once quite literally backwaters. Arix, on the edge of the outfitter's district, was a windowless concrete block box with a steel door and broken neon and a parking lot full of pickups, Cadillacs, and El Caminos, cowboy Cadillacs. But no French music. I drank a Dixie and ate bar peanuts and asked the bartender where I could hear Chanky Chank, as Cajuns call their music. She, too, drew a map, but her knowledge gave out before she got to the destination. "It's called Tees. It's down one of these roads, but they all look alike to me out there."
"Out there?"
"It's in the country. Follow my map and you'll be within a couple miles." When I left, she said good luck. The traveler should stand warned when he gets wished luck. I followed her map until the lights of Lafayette were just a glowing sky and the land was black. I wound about, crossing three identical bridges, or crossing one bridge three times. I gave up and tried to find my way back to town and couldn't do that either. Then a red glow like a campfire. A beer sign. Hearty music rolled out the open door of a small tavern, and a scent of simmering hot peppers steamed from the stovepipe chimney. I'd found Tees. Inside, under dim halos of yellow bug lights, an accordion, the heart of a Cajun band, a fiddle, guitar, and ting-a-ling, triangle, cranked out Chanky Chank. The accordionist introduced the numbers as songs of amour or joie, and the patrons cheered. But when he announced En Chanson de Mariage, they booed him. Many times he cried out the Cajun motto, Laissez les bons temps rouler! While the good times rolled, I sat at the bar next to a man dying to talk. My Yankee ass and his were the only ones in the place. His name was Joe Seipel, and his speech, Great Lakes. I asked, "You from Wisconsin?"
"Minnesota. But I've been here 7 years working for PHI.
"What's PHI? He put down his bottle and gave me an exaggerated, wide-eyed, open-mouthed look to indicate my shocking ignorance.
"You gotta be kidding."
"About what?"
"Petroleum Helicopters Incorporated."
He shook his head.
"Jeez."
"Oh, that's right. What kind of helicoptering do you do?" I tried to talk between numbers, but he talked through it all.
"I don't fly. I'm a mechanic. But Stoney here flies out to the offshore rigs. Delivers materials, crews, you know."
The pilot, in his 50s, wore cowboy boots and a jaunty avocado jumpsuit. He was applying a practiced Bridges of Toco Re machismo to a hugely mammaried woman who had painted on a pair of arched red lips, the likes of which the true face of womankind has never known. Seipel said,
"I was just like you when I came here, dumb as hell. But I've read about Louisiana, learned about coon asses from that yellow book."
"What yellow book is that?"
"That one comes out every month."
"National Geographic?"
"That's it. They had a story on coon asses."
"Did they explain the name coon ass?"
"I think they missed that."
A small, slew-footed Gallic man wearing a silky shirt with a pelican on it dragged an upturned metal washtub next to the band and climbed on. I think he'd taken out his dentures. A mop handle with baling twine tied to it projected from the tub, and he thrust the stick about in rhythm with the music, plucking out the sound of a double bass.
"That's DePaul, on the gut bucket," Seipel said. "He's not with the band."
After a couple of numbers on the tub, the small man hopped down and waltzed around the floor, quite alone, snapping his wrists, making sharp, rapid clacks with four things that looked like big ivory dominoes.
"Those are the bones," Seipel said. "Sort of Cajun castanets."
When the band folded for the night, the little fellow sashayed to the lighted jukebox, drawn to it like a moth, and clacked the bones in fine syncopation, his red tongue flicking out the better to help him syncopate, his cropped orb of a head glowing darkly. Seipel hollered him over. He showed how to hold the bones, one on each side of the middle fingers, then flung out his wrist as if throwing off water, and let loose a report like the crack of a bullwhip.
"Try them in your hands."
The bones were smooth, like old jade. I laboriously inserted the 4-inch counters between my fingers and snapped my wrist. Cluck, cluck.
"Lousy,"
Seipel said.
I tried again. Cluck, cluck.
Wet sponges had more resonance. Seipel shook his head, so I handed them to him. He got them mounted, lashed out an arm, and a bone sailed across the room.
"You boys don't got it,"
DePaul said, his words looping in the old Cajun way. DePaul's name was in fact Paul Duhon. He had cut the clappers from a certain leg bone in a steer and carved them down to proper shape and a precise thickness. "You got to have de right bone, or de sound she muffle, and de steer got to be big for de good ringin' bones." I tried again. Cluck, cluck. "I work at dis 40 years, Duhon said, "and just now do I start getting it right. Look at me, getting old and just now getting good. Dat's why only old men play de good bones." "Where'd you learn to make them?" "Old color man. He work on de railroad. He got nothing, but he loved music, so he played our bones. He played them in de old minstrel shows. He de one day call, Mr. Bones. And at Mr. Bones hisself, he show me carving. Now people say, come play us de bones in Shreveport. But de bones just for fun." "DePaul flies kites," Seiple said. "Once in the Guinness Book. My kites, they fly for time in de air, not how high. Someday, I want people to be remembering Duhon. I want Duhon wrote down." "I can play the musical saw," Seiple said, and called to the barmaid. "Got a saw here?" She pushed him a salt shaker. "What's this?" "That's the saw you're yelling for." Seiple and I laughed, holding on to the bar. Duhon went home. Everybody went home. The barmaid watched us wearily. "Okay," she said. "Come on back for some hot stuff." "Is this where we find out why they call themselves coonasses?" I said, and we laughed again, holding on to each other. "All right, boys, settle down." She led us not to a bedroom, but to a large concrete floor kitchen with an old picnic table under a yellow fluorescent tube. We sat, and a young Cajun named Michael passed a long loaf of French bread. The woman put two bowls on the oilcloth and ladled up gumbo. Now, I've eaten my share of gumbo, but never had I tasted anything like that gumbo. The oysters were fresh and fat, the shrimp succulent, the spiced sausage meaty, okra sweet, rice soft, and the roux, the essence. The roux was right. We could almost stand our spoons on end in it. The roots of Cajun cookery come from Brittany, and bear no resemblance to Parisian cuisine, and not even much to the Creole cooking of New Orleans. Those are haute cuisine of the city, and Cajun food belongs to the country, where things got mixed up over the generations. No one even knows the source of the word gumbo. Some say it derives from an African word for okra, chingombo, while others believe it a corruption of a Choctaw word for sassafras, combo, the key seasoning. The woman disappeared, so we ate gumbo and dipped bread, and no one talked. A gray cat hopped on the bench between Seiple and me to watch each bite of both bowls we ate. Across the room, a fat, buffy mouse moved over the stovetop and browsed for drippings from the big pot. The cat eyed it every so often, but made no move away from our bowls. Seiple said, "I've enjoyed the hell out of tonight," and he laid out a small shrimp for the cat. Nothing more got spoken. We all went at the gumbo, each of us, Minnesotan, Cajun, cat, mouse, Missourian. 11. Sometime in the darkness of morning, the rain started. It pecked, then pelted, then fell in a steady, soft patter on the steel roof of Ghost Dancing, and my sleep was without shadows. At 6:30, the sky was still dark, the rain falling steadily. An hour later, rain. 2 hours later, no change. I got up, washed, ate some fruit and cheese. I draped across the bunk and read, occasionally looking into the gray obscuring rain, listening to thunder, puts the sugar in the cane, watching Spanish moss, a relative of the pineapple, hang still in the trees like shredded, dingy bedsheets. At 10:30, the rain dropped straight down, as if from a faucet. I was able to leave the front windows half open. I didn't know then, but in April in coastal Louisiana, you don't wait for the rain to stop unless you have all day and night. Which I did. reading my notes of the trip, images, bits of conversations, ideas. I hunted a structure in the events. But randomness was the rule. Outside, sheltered by a live oak, a spider spun a web. Can an orb weaver perceive the design in its work, the pattern of concentric circles lying atop radiating lines? When the mystical young black elk went to the summit of Harney Peak to see the shape of things, he looked down on the great unifying hoop of peoples. I looked down and saw fragments. But later that afternoon, a tactic returned to me from night maneuver training in the Navy. To see in deep darkness, you don't look directly at an object. You look to the left. You look at something else to see what you really want to see. Skewed vision. At 5:30, the rain stopped. It didn't ease. It just stopped. I walked through the west side of Lafayette, where I'd parked for the night, and day, as it turned out. The wetness deepened the tones of things as if the rain had been droplets of color. Azaleas dripped blood-red blossoms. Camellias oozed carmine. The puddly ground squelched under me. The overcast moved east, like a gray woolen blanket being pulled back, and the sun came in low beneath a wrinkling of clouds. Then a sunset happened, a gaudy polychrome sky, mauve, cerise, puce, so garish I couldn't take my eyes away. On a front porch, threatened with a turbulence of blooming vegetation, a man stood before his barbecue grill, the ghostly blue smoke rising like incense. His belly a drooping bag, his face slack, he watched the coals burn to a glow. He'd built many briquette fires. The man's numb stasis disturbed me. Got to get moving, I thought, and hurried to my rig and drove to Bro Bridge, the crawfish capital of the world. I was looking for a crawdad supper, Bro Bridge on the Bayou Teche, stirred slowly with an awakened sense of Acadianism. CODAFIL, an organization working to preserve Cajun traditions and language, had placed signs in the dusty shop windows, things like Soyons fiers de parler français, or Parler français, c'est de l'argent en poche. I asked a man locking a store where to eat crawfish. He sent me east across the bayou, through banks of willow and hanging moss, past little fence post signs advertising Evangeline-made bread, past front yard shrines to the Virgin, past lots piled with fishing gear. At Henderson, I found a wooden building hanging over Bayou Peyronet, just below the massive west levee of the Atchafalaya River Basin. The heavy air of increase smelled of marine creatures and mud and hot peppers. On the roof of Pat's restaurant sat a 6-foot red plastic model of the Cajun totem, a boiled crawdad. The menu claimed the catfish were fresh because they had slept the night before in the Atchafalaya. All well and good. But it was little crustaceans I was after. As journalist Calvin Trillin once said, the Atchafalaya swamp is to crawfish as the Serengeti to lions. The waitress wore threads of wrinkles woven like chantilly lace over her forehead and spoke her English in quick, rounded Cajun measures. She brought a metal beer tray piled with boiled whole crawfish glowing the color of Louisiana hot sauce. I worked my way down through the stack. The meat was soft and piquant, sweeter than shrimp, but I had no stomach for the buttery yellow fat the Cajuns were sucking from the shells. The waitress said, "Did they eat lovely like mortal sin?" and winked a lacy eyelid. "You know the Cajun, he sometime call them mud bugs, but I never tell a customer that until he all full inside. But the crawfish, he lives smiling in the mud, he do." "They're just miniature lobsters." "Are you Cajun? Don't you know that now, Cher?" "Do you use your French?" "Time to time, but not like my old aunt. She don't speak English except des at the door, and then it sound like her French. People you age understand, but don't speak it much, no. And the kids, they don't tell French from Eskimo. Schools, they hire 100 teachers to give little ones French, but teachers, they teach Paris people's French. Hell, we speak Cajun us.
The teachers, they look down at their noses on Cajun, so we don't care. I'm afraid for Cajun. Us, we're the last. But when I was a girl on the schoolyard, when they opened the day with Raisin' Old Glory, we sing the Marseillaise. We thought it was America's song. In the warm night that came on to relieve the colors of the day, I went down through the rockless, liquid land, down along the Bayou Teche to St. Martinville, a crumbling hamlet where the past was the future. 12. Talk about your three persons in one controversies. In St. Martinville, a bronze statue of a seated young woman in wooden shoes, hands folded peacefully, head turned toward the Bayou Teche, commemorates, at one and the same time, Emmeline Labiche, Evangeline Bellefontaine, and Dolores del Rio. The monument sits in the Poste de Atacapas Cemetery, behind the great Catholic church of Saint-Martin-de-Tours. After the bayou, the cemetery and church are the oldest things in town. The cruciform building, full of flickering candles, bloodied crucifixes, anguished representations of the Stations of the Cross, and plaster saints with maces and drawn swords, contains in one wing a 12-foot-high replica of the Grotto of Lourdes. Although Mass is now celebrated in English, the place, with its ancient torments, remains quite French in the old manner. The bronze woman sits, literally, above the 18th-century grave of Emmeline Labiche, who, Cajuns say, wandered primitive America in search of her lover, Louis Arsenault, whom she was separated from during the forced Acadian exodus, Le Grand Dérangement, out of British Nova Scotia. At the army outpost on the Teche, she finally found Louis, engaged to another. Emmeline, exhausted from her wanderings, went mad from the shock of his faithlessness, and died shortly later. They buried her behind the church. That's history. But the name on the statue above Emmeline's tombstone is Evangeline. Cajuns believe Longfellow patterned his wandering heroine on Emmeline, and probably he did, although the poet never visited Louisiana, relying instead on information furnished by Nathaniel Hawthorne and a St. Martinville lawyer, once Longfellow's student at Harvard. To visualize the land, he went to Banvard's Moving Diorama of the Mississippi, a 3-mile-long canvas painting of a boat-level view. Longfellow said the river came to him. He filled in with details from Darby's geographical description of Louisiana and his own imagination, changing the outcome so that in old age, Evangeline at last finds her love on his deathbed in a Philadelphia almshouse. That's the poetry. Then there's Hollywood. The face on the statue, smooth and beautiful and untouched by madness or years of wandering the wilderness, is that of Dolores del Rio, the Mexican-born actress who completed the Trinity by playing Evangeline in the 1929 movie, filmed nearby at Lake Catahoula. To thank the townspeople, the cast presented a statue of Evangeline Emmeline that Miss Del Rio posed for. The actress, cynics said, saw a chance to have her beauty immortalized in something more durable than celluloid. If many citizens no longer know the name, they all know the face. St. Martinville was pure Cajun bayou, distinctive and memorable in a tattered way. Wood and iron galleries were rickety, brick buildings eroded, corrugated metal roofs rusting. The church stood on the square, the courthouse down Main Street. On the upper side of the square that morning, Maurice Oubre's bakery turned out the last of the day's pastry. And on the west side, at Thibodeau's Cafe and Barbershop, Mr. Thibodeau had been cutting hair since 5 a.m. Across the street, taverns got swept out, and the smell of last night's beer, mixed with Thibodeau's thick café noir, Oubre's croissants, and the damp air off the Teche. In the Petit Paris de l'Amérique museum gift shop next to the church, a powdery old lady asked the priest to bless a souvenir candle she'd just bought. He waved his hand over it and said, "May God bless this candle and all who use it, in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit." Above his head on the Coke machine, a sign, "Shoplifting is a crime and sin. God sees all and remembers."
Sin was underlined 3 times. 13. Because of a broken sealed beam headlight and sat around